England Before the Reformation. Chapter 12. Wolsey. Just as everything seemed tending to a reformation, a powerful priest rendered the way more difficult. One of the most striking personages of the age was then making his appearance on the stage of the world. It was the destiny of that man, in the reign of Henry VIII, to combine extreme ability with extreme immortality, and to be a new and striking example of the wholesome truth that immorality is more effectual to destroy a man than ability to save him. Wolsey was the last high priest of Rome in England, and when his fall startled the nation, it was the signal of a still more striking fall, the fall of popery. Thomas Wolsey, the son of a wealthy butcher of Ipswich, according to the common story, which is sanctioned by high authority, had attained under Henry VII the post of almoner, at the recommendation of Sir Richard Nafan, treasurer of Calais and an old patron of his. But Wolsey was not at all desirous of passing his life in saying mass. As soon as he had discharged the regular duties of his office, instead of spending the rest of the day in idleness, as his colleagues did, he strove to win the good graces of the persons round the king. Fox, Bishop of Winchester, keeper of the Privy Seal under Henry VII, uneasy at the growing power of the Earl of Surrey, looked about for a man to counterbalance him. He thought he had found such a one in Wolsey. It was to oppose the Surreys, the grandfather and uncles of Anne Boleyn, that the son of the Ipswich butcher was drawn from his obscurity. This is not an unimportant circumstance in our narrative. Fox began to praise Wolsey in the king's hearing, and at the same time he encouraged the almoner to give himself to public affairs. The latter was not deaf, and soon found an opportunity of winning his sovereign's favor. The king, having business of importance with the emperor, who was then in Flanders, sent for Wolsey, explained his wishes, and ordered him to prepare to set out. The chaplain determined to show Henry VII how capable he was of serving him. It was long past noon when he took leave of the king at Richmond. At 4 o'clock he was in London, at 7 at Gravesend. By traveling all night he reached Dover just as the packet boat was about to sail. After a passage of 3 hours he reached Calais, whence he traveled post, and the same evening appeared before Maximilian. Having obtained what he desired, he set off again by night, and on the next day but one reached Richmond, 3 days and some few hours after his departure. The king, catching sight of him just as he was going to mass, sharply inquired why he had not set out. "Sire, I am just returned," answered Wolsey, placing the emperor's letters in his master's hands. Henry was delighted, and Wolsey saw that his fortune was made. The courtiers hoped at first that Wolsey, like an inexperienced pilot, would run his vessel on some hidden rock, but never did helmsman manage his ship with more skill. Although 20 years older than Henry VIII, the almoner danced, and sang, and laughed with the prince's companions, and amused his new master with tales of scandal and quotations from Thomas Aquinas. The young king found his house a temple of paganism, a shrine of voluptuousness, and while Henry's counselors were entreating him to leave his pleasures and attend to business, Wolsey was continually reminding him that he ought to devote his youth to learning and amusement, and leave the toils of government to others. Wolsey was created Bishop of Tournai during the campaign in Flanders, and on his return to England, was raised to the sees of Lincoln and of York. 3 mitres had been placed on his head in 1 year. He found at last the vein he so ardently sought for. And yet he was not satisfied. The Archbishop of Canterbury had insisted, as primate, that the cross of York should be lowered to his. Wolsey was not of a disposition to concede this, and when he found that Warham was not content with being his equal, he resolved to make him his inferior. He wrote to Paris and to Rome. Francis I, who desired to conciliate England, demanded the purple for Wolsey, and the Archbishop of York received the title of Cardinal Street Cecilia beyond the Tiber. In November 1515, his hat was brought by the envoy of the Pope. "It would have been better to have given him a Tyburn tippet," said some indignant Englishman. "These Romish hats never brought good into England," a saying that has become proverbial. This was not enough for Wolsey. He desired secular greatness above all things. Warham, tired of contending with so arrogant a rival, resigned the seals, and the king immediately transferred them to the cardinal. At length a bull appointed him legate a latir of the Holy See, and placed under his jurisdiction all the colleges, monasteries, spiritual courts, bishops, and the primate himself, 1519. From that time, as Lord Chancellor of England and legate, Wolsey administered everything in church and state. He filled his coffers with money procured both at home and from abroad, and yielded without restraint to his dominant vices, ostentation and pride. Whenever he appeared in public, two priests, the tallest and comeliest that could be found, carried before him two huge silver crosses, one to mark his dignity as archbishop, the other as papal legate. Chamberlains, gentlemen, pages, sergeants, chaplains, choristers, clerks, cupbearers, cooks, and other domestics, to the number of more than 500, among whom were 9 or 10 lords and the stateliest yeomen of the country, filled his palace. He generally wore a dress of scarlet velvet and silk, with hat and gloves of the same color. His shoes were embroidered with gold and silver, inlaid with pearls and precious stones. A kind of papacy was thus forming in England, for wherever pride flourishes, there popery is developed. One thing occupied Wolsey more than all the pomp with which he was surrounded, his desire, namely, to captivate the king. For this purpose he cast Henry's nativity, and procured an amulet which he wore constantly, in order to charm his master by its magic properties. Then having recourse to a still more effectual necromancy, he selected from among the licentious companions of the young monarch those of the keenest discernment and most ambitious character, and after binding them to him by a solemn oath, he placed them at court to be as eyes and ears to him. Accordingly, not a word was said in the presence of the monarch, particularly against Wolsey, of which he was not informed an hour afterwards. If the culprit was not in favor, he was expelled without mercy. In the contrary case, the minister sent him on some distant mission. The queen's ladies, the king's chaplains, and even their confessors, were the cardinal's spies. He pretended to omnipresence, as the pope to infallibility. Wolsey was not devoid of certain showy virtues, for he was liberal to the poor even to affectation, and as chancellor inexorable to every kind of irregularity, and strove particularly to make the rich and high-born bend beneath his power. Men of learning alone obtained from him some little attention, and hence Erasmus calls him the Achates of a new Aeneas. But the nation was not to be carried away by the eulogies of a few scholars. Wolsey, a man of more than suspected morals, double-hearted, faithless to his promises, oppressing the people with heavy taxes, and exceedingly arrogant to everybody, Wolsey soon became hated by the people of England. The elevation of a prince of the Roman Church could not be favorable to the Reformation. The priests, encouraged by it, determined to make a stand against the triple attack of the learned, the reformers, and the state, and they soon had an opportunity of trying their strength. Holy orders had become during the Middle Ages a warrant for every sort of crime. Parliament, desirous of correcting this abuse and checking the encroachments of the Church, declared in the year that any ecclesiastic accused of theft or murder should be tried before the secular tribunals. Exceptions, however, were made in favor of bishops, priests, and deacons, that is to say, nearly all the clergy. Notwithstanding this timid precaution, an insolent clerk, the Abbot of Winchelcombe, began the battle by exclaiming at St. Paul's, "Touch not mine anointed," said the Lord. At the same time Wolsey, accompanied by a long train of priests and prelates, had an audience of the king, at which he said with hands upraised to heaven, "Sire, to try a clerk is a violation of God's laws." This time, however, Henry did not give way. "By God's will, we are king of England," he replied, "and the kings of England in times past had never any superior but God only. Therefore know you well that we will maintain the right of our crown." He saw distinctly that to put the clergy above the laws was to put them above the throne. The priests were beaten, but not disheartened. Perseverance is a characteristic feature of every hierarchical order. Not walking by faith, they walk all the more by sight, and skillful combinations supply the place of the holy aspirations of the Christian. Humble disciples of the gospel were soon to experience this, for the clergy by a few isolated attacks were about to flesh themselves for the great struggles of the Reformation.